All right. If you guys have your Bibles, if you want to open up to 1 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to keep going through our study through 1 Samuel. The account of how Israel got a king. How it moved from a theocracy to a monarchy. In our story last time, it was one of the, probably the most famous stories of the Bible. We looked at how David went up against Goliath, the giant of the Philistines, and how the Lord delivered Israel through David's hand, and we made a lot of observations about David. And one of the things we pointed out is that on most of these accounts, as we're looking at David's life, as we're examining, you know, the things that have transpired in his life and his rise to power as a king, we're being given a revelation of what it is to be a man after God's own heart. What it is to be a person. When God said that he was going to raise up a king, he said, I'm going to raise up one who is after my own heart, a man after my own heart. So there's two aspects to that. In the story of David, we're getting a picture of what it's like to be someone whose heart is hard after the Lord, whose loyalty is sworn to him, who builds his identity out of his relationship with God. But we're also getting a type of Christ as well. We're getting a picture of what Jesus was going to be like. We're getting a picture of the heart of God as well. We're being brought into an understanding of what it means to recognize the work of the Lord, or to see what characterizes his ways. So those are the things that we're going to be recognizing and realizing as we go through this and we see David's story unfold before us. So where we left off last time, David, remember, went up against the giant, defeated him, and took his head off, and Saul was wanting to know who this was, and so Abner went and found out who it was brought back word to Saul, and then he was presented before Saul. David was presented before Saul, and that's kind of where we left off. He wanted to know who he was. So we pick up here in chapter 18. We start in verse 1. It says, now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. Now, sometime after the battle with the Philistines, we know that when we left off in chapter 17, It was after the slaughter of the Philistines, so we know that it wasn't immediately. We know that it wasn't, you know, like sometimes we can read these accounts in the Bible and we think, yeah, David walked in from the field after fighting Goliath, and that's when all these things happened. But it says after the slaughter of the Philistines. That's a campaign that's taken some time. So some time has passed before he's come before Saul here, and it says then after he meets up with Saul, that he's presented before, after he comes back from that battle, he's presented before Saul. And this probably, this time period that we're looking at the beginning of this chapter probably coincides with chapter 16 and how David even first came into the palace. And we talked about that last time, how there's kind of maybe a bit of a flashback here. But we see here the most important aspect of this is that Jonathan and David strike up a friendship. And this is going to be an important friendship as this story unfolds. But it's a strong friendship. I mean, when you look at Jonathan and David, you realize they got a lot in common as guys anyway. I mean, they're bold warriors. They've gone out. They're impetuous in battle. Both of them have done amazing feats. Remember earlier when we were first introduced to Jonathan, he and his armor bearer had scaled up a cliff and took out a whole garrison just by the two of them in a battle. And so there are similarities between these guys anyway. So you could see how they would become friends. It's one of these things. It's hard to know. The Bible doesn't give us explicit details on this, but most scholars believe that Jonathan would be older. They put an age setting on that between, you know, 5 and 8 years. Honestly, I don't know why. I couldn't get anybody to give me an explanation as to how they came up with those numbers, so it makes me nervous repeating them. But for some reason, everybody thinks he's somewhere around 5 to 8 years older than David. And these are people that are smarter than me, so I'll take their word for it, I guess. you look at this friendship, and it's an unusual friendship when you really start to break it down and think about it a little bit, because Jonathan really has a lot to fear from David. Jonathan is the firstborn son of a king. He is the next in line for the throne of Israel. And now all of a sudden, Israel's got a brand new hero. Israel's got this giant killer kid that everybody's looking at and everybody's in love with and they're thrilled about. And so there's a lot that Jonathan should be nervous about when it comes to this kind of a friendship with this guy. And yet, their friendship seems to be quite solid. In fact, their friendship bypasses all the normal boundaries that you would think of in terms of even these political considerations, or if you think about familial background. I mean, Jonathan is the firstborn son of a king. David is the youngest son of a farmer from some little podunk town outside of Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem isn't even there now, but you know, at this stage in the game, that's the whole idea. So it's a strange thing, and it's a remarkable friendship in that so quickly it says that their souls are knit together. And this is strong language that's being used here by the narrator. The concept is that they are fast friends. They're like brothers. They're knit together like as if they're one. In fact, it even says they make a covenant with each other, which is a curious thing. Now, back in the old days when you were kids, you used to do that thing where you'd prick your finger, you know, and you'd be blood brother friends. I don't think anybody does that now. It's not wise anyway with the world the way it is. But we used to do that kind of, you spit in your hand and, you know, but it's that same kind of thing. They made a covenant between themselves that they were going to hold on to their friendship, that this friendship was going to be something that lasted. That's a fairly remarkable thing given the circumstances, given the danger and the threat that David poses to Jonathan's future kingdom. So it's a curiosity, to say the least, but it's pretty cool. I mean, Jonathan even goes as far as to provide for David the accoutrements of what a prince should have. He gives him a robe, the concept of, you know, priest or princely garments. He gives him armor, which provides for him the military strength and the might that he'd need, which puts him in the realm of royalty. So he's elevating him. Whereas, you know, he could have kept him in a certain subservient level, he actually elevates him to an equal plane. Clearly, he doesn't have any political consideration. You know, when we think today in our world of power plays and political ambition, I mean, it's an unheard of thing to think that somebody would put friendship and loyalty to somebody in this high esteem, that they'd be willing to risk their own position of power. Well, I don't know of anybody like that in the world of politics in our day. So it's a very interesting thing. There is almost something about Jonathan's response to David that it's almost as though he seems to know what David's destiny is. Now, it doesn't say that in the text, and we have no indication that he would have known that at this point in the story. And yet, there's a certain way in which he's operating that gives you the sense that he's in the know on this. But even if he's not, what we realize is that God is. God's the one who is the one who anointed David to be king. And so he's working to orchestrate all of these things. He's the one who's behind this. He's the one moving this in their hearts so that this friendship develops. And David, this little nobody shepherd kid, the paper boy, remember, he's a nobody in that society, is now suddenly in the court of the king and decked out as a prince and standing in equality, making covenants with the firstborn son of the king, just like a prince would do. Only God could have put all that together. Samuel, remember when he anointed David, he anointed him and he smiled and said, "See you, kid. There's no way I can do this. No way I'm going to figure out how to make this happen. Only God can do this." And here we see God do it. God leads him down a path where he's tackling giants and suddenly in the court of the king. It's an amazing move on God's part. Now, the love that is shared between these two men has posed a lot of questions over time, and it, to me, provides an answer for those who want to propose a legitimacy to the homosexual lifestyle. They will say, "Well, see, there's love. I mean, how can it be wrong? You know, when the Christian perspective excludes the idea of homosexuality as being appropriate behavior, they say, how can that be true? How can it be wrong to love? The Bible tells us to love. We're supposed to be able to love. And my answer is there's absolutely no prohibition about love. Here we find love between these two men, and it's quite legitimate and a wonderful thing. Love is not the question. Love has never been the question. The question is sex. The question comes down to sex. Love is beautiful and it's noble, and love, the way the Bible describes love and expresses what love is, there's nothing wrong between two people of the same gender loving each other. The problem comes down to sex. Sex has a very narrow definition for how it's to be used. It's confined within the marriage relationship between a male and a female. Anything outside of that is sin in God's perspective. So love isn't the question. It's a pointless and a futile argument to try to say that we're condemning love if we say that homosexuality is incorrect. No, we're not. Love has never been the question. The question is sex. And that makes it a far more base sort of question when you think of it that way. I mean, we're not talking about a noble ideal here. We are talking about one of the baser instincts, that of the sexual drive. So there's nothing wrong with love. Love is a wonderful thing. And love between these two guys, perfectly legitimate, a wonderful expression of God's heart. David is a man after God's own heart, is knit together with this man, and he loves him as his own brother, as his own soul. Nothing wrong with that at all. All right, verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants, or the other leadership in Israel. And now it happened, as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced, and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they've ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward. Okay, so you notice here, David has been anointed by Samuel, the great prophet, as king over Israel. And obviously an exchange took place between those two, that David is aware of his destiny. And yet, there's nothing in this narrative that suggests that David is out there trying to work anything to his favor. We don't see anything in this text that indicates that David's working behind the scenes and trying to get something worked out to where he's going to, you know, do a power play and overthrow Saul or do anything. David, it says, is just going out and behaving wisely. In other words, he's just following after the Lord. He's loving God like he always has. He's being himself. He's being given wisdom as he goes along, and it's all working towards his benefit. No scheming, no manipulating. You know, so often when we feel like the Lord is leading us in a direction or showing us some way that he wants us to go, don't you know how it happens sometimes that the gears start turning and we start figuring out how we're going to make this happen and how we're going to get the Lord's will accomplished in this or that way. And yet we don't see any of that from David's side. David just quietly and humbly puts that in God's hand and goes out to do the best that he can in the circumstances that he's faced with. I think it's a great rule of thumb. The Lord gives us wisdom, maybe gives us a direction in some way that we're supposed to go. The best thing for us to do is not to try to make that thing happen, but just to do the best that we can do in the circumstances that we're in, living to represent God in the world that he's placed us. And the Lord will take care of the rest, just as he's going to do here. What we see from David is that he seems to be a loyal and obedient servant to the king, Saul. There's nothing in here that suggests anything that he's trying to undermine Saul's authority in the process. And so Saul sets David basically as a general. And you got to figure he's young at this point. The campaign of the slaughter of the Philistines is still going on. And so now all of a sudden he's got to be, you know, young 20s, I suppose. It could even be younger than that. And now he's a general, basically, in charge of whole squads of soldiers that he's commanding. And he does well with it. You know, obviously the Lord's giving him wisdom, and he's working as a good tactician. And so his his success on the battlefield is causing a certain level of popularity to begin to develop, a groundswell of popularity for David. Now all of a sudden there's this new kid on the block. Everybody used to, you know, be all about Saul, man. Saul is the best. He's head and shoulders everybody else. Good looking guy, captain of the football team. He's our man. And now all of a sudden here's David, and David is going out and doing amazing things. He kills giants. He slaughters Philistines. He's commanding the armies. He's got it going on. Not only that, he's a mean musician, man. He's a rock star. So, I mean, he's got a lot of things going for him all of a sudden, and it's not something contrived by him. It's just a natural response of the people around him as they see him living out this life, as he's living out the life that God's given him to live. So he's loved by the people and loved by the servants. It's all that is the leadership of Israel, the others who are in charge of Israel. And so everybody likes David all of a sudden. This is pretty cool. And it's all coming to him not because he's seeking popularity, but because he's doing the best that he can do in the circumstances that he's placed in. And, you know, again, I hate to keep making all these references to our present culture, but when you think about, you know, we're coming up on elections, and you think about how politicians behave in our world, I mean, this is, I mean, the polar opposite of politicians as we understand them. They go out and glad hand and do everything that they can do to win everybody's favor and get everybody on their side, but David isn't doing any of that. David is just pursuing and doing things wisely, pursuing God's will for his life, and the result of it is that he is enjoying this popularity. Now, the problem is when David's popularity begins to eclipse Saul's accomplishments, and you see how the women come out. You know, you figure that the imagery here is that these are the soldiers that are coming back from the battle. You know, they're heading back through cities that they've had to pass through. Maybe soldiers are heading back to their towns of origin, and as they're coming in, you know, the long column of soldiers are marching in, and the women who've been waiting for their soldier husbands or fathers are all coming out, and there's joy and there's dancing, and you know, they're waving their tambourines and they're doing the rhythmic dances, and they're all stoked and happy, and they begin singing this song that they just make up on the fly. And as they're singing along, they're talking about Saul has slain his thousands, and he's feeling good. He's on his horse. He's going, "That's the truth, man. I've done it." And then all of a sudden he hears the other lyrics to the song that say, "And David has slain tens of thousands." And all of a sudden, even though Saul has been praised, I mean, he was just praised in the song, but because he wasn't praised as much as David, everything falls apart in Saul's equations of things. He is so paranoid and neurotic at this point. And it comes across in the text. I mean, they do a very good job of presenting a case scenario of a person who's falling into some severe psychological difficulties and problems in his life. Paranoia clearly is setting in with Saul. You can figure from the moment that Samuel said to him, "The kingdom's going to be wrested from you. You are not going to have this kingdom anymore, neither will your children." And when Saul grabbed at him as Samuel turned away and ripped the robe out of his hand, ripped the piece of the robe, and Samuel basically said, "That's all you've got, a token of your kingdom. Another one after God's own heart, is being raised up to take your place." You can figure from that moment forward, Saul is spiraling down into this strange well of paranoia, looking around at everybody around him. Is he the one? Is he going to be the one who usurps my kingdom? Where's he going to come from? What's he going to do? How's this going to happen? And so the suspicion just gnaws at him and eats at him, so that at this moment, when they're coming back from this victorious battle, a time when he should be celebrating and joyful and happy that he's got a general like this who's able to do these great deeds, instead he begins to sink into this envy and jealousy and hatred, because he hears that more kills are ascribed to David than they are to him. So, I mean, you know, he's right away thinking about how he's going to maintain his power base. And knowing Saul like we do now, this is no surprise to us. Now, as he looks at David, I love the way the wording is here. He says he eyed David from that day forward, you know, viewed him with suspicion is the concept in it. But I like the way it's worded. It gave him the old evil eye from that moment on. He's going to take care of him. So verse 10. And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand, as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped his presence twice. All right. So the very next day, Saul has one of his spells. He's, you know, and we've talked about this before. Perplexing verse, you know, what does this mean? A distressing spirit from God? Does God send distressing spirits? This, the word that's used here for spirit still does not indicate an actual entity. We don't have to ascribe a demonic spirit to this. This could be just an attitude or a vexed state of mind. Clearly, Saul is going through some real psychological difficulties. We see that from the way he's behaving. So more than likely, there's some serious neurosis that's working on him here, and he's having a fit. And then it says that he prophesied, and that seems like an odd thing. You know, what is that talking about? He's walking around prophesying. So God sends distressing spirits and people prophesy. What is this all about? Well, again, we get back into the language. It's a kind of a wonky translation there, because the word for prophecy doesn't always just mean a prophecy from the Lord. It can also mean a false prophecy. It can also mean incoherent babblings. So, you know, to say prophesy, I think, is a little bit of a stretch. I think they should have used one of the variants of the word's meanings there. Because I think more than likely the idea behind it is Saul is having one of his spells. He's walking around the house. He's babbling like a madman. Or he's praying incoherently, praying vain prayers to the Lord. That could be the idea behind that. Or even more so, we could say that he's falsely prophesying to himself. He's trying to encourage himself. Well, God is going to get me out of this. It's all going to be okay. God is on my side. He's not on anybody else's side. Vainly prophesying or falsely prophesying to encourage himself, you know, confirming himself in his own evil ways. You know, self-deception. Self-deception is a very frightening thing to me. When a person allows themselves to be deceived and reinforces that same sense of deception, well, I mean, how do you come to out of something like that? Self-deception, that's something that's imposed from within, and how does a person claw their way out of that? I don't know. It's a strange and frightening concept to me. So anyway, you know, we know the scenario from chapter 16. This kind of distress would come on Saul, and so they'd need some kind of music. So David is called in, and David starts rocking out. He plugs in the amp, probably starts doing like a Van Halen-style lead or something, and to try to calm Saul down. But it just so happened that while David's got a guitar in his hand, Saul's hefting a spear in his hand. You know, just happens to be holding his spear and kind of checking the balance on it and stuff like that. And so right in the middle of David's ripping lead and everything like that, it says that all of a sudden Saul just, boom, you know, clearly he's not a metal fan. He's probably a John Denver fan, and that's probably what the problem is here. But anyway, so he chucks his spear right at him, and it says in there, this isn't an accident. This isn't something that some people have tried to ascribe to this. Well, you know, a demonic spirit took over his will and he couldn't resist. Well, no, not at all. Actually, it says very, very clearly this was premeditated on Saul's part. His thought was, you know what? I'm going to pin him to the wall. I need decorations. This would be perfect. And so he throws that spear with the intent to murder David. His purpose in that is to take him out, and it's an attempt on his life. So now it says here, and this is what I think is really interesting, and there's just a huge amount of kind of like details left out, but yet they're there in the, you know, in the brief description of this, because it says that David escaped. And I think that's interesting, because it doesn't say anything about the spear coming flying back at Saul. You know, here's David. He's escaped from a bear. He's escaped from a lion. God delivered him from a giant. Why would he be afraid of Saul? You know, to me, there's an incredible amount of restraint revealed in David's heart. How he's not picking that spear. He's not pulling that spear out of the wall and saying, okay, old man, it's on. And, you know, throwing it back and forth in a big spear battle breaks out up in the throne room. There's no account of that at all. David, he says, escapes. David didn't need to escape. David is a warrior. He's a brilliant tactician. He could have taken Saul out. But because of his heart, because his heart is after God's own heart, there's humility here. There's a reverence even for the authority that's there, regardless of Saul's evil intentions, regardless of Saul's evil behavior at that time, clearly David has a regard and a loyalty to the kingdom itself. And so he's not about to go after Saul, who later on we'll see he goes to great lengths to keep from doing anything against the one that God had put in power. He calls him God's anointed. And so there's an incredible revelation of his heart that here, after he's been attacked like this, he's not retaliating. He's not picking that up. And we think back to how Jesus talks about blessed are the peacemakers, and how he prompted us that if someone were to strike us on one cheek, that our calling as followers of God is not to retaliate and take the person out, but to turn the other cheek and reveal in that the heart of God, the heart of the kingdom. So, you know, he's willing to let Saul act out in the flesh. Saul did, but David isn't going to reciprocate in the same way. He's not going to act out in the flesh himself. David is realizing that he is in God's hands. He's not in Saul's hands. And by escaping like that, he's revealing that his trust is in God, that he doesn't have to retaliate, that he doesn't have to put this king down. But I'll tell you what's even more remarkable to me is the final word on there. It says twice, which means that David had to come back at some other time and be playing again, and this thing had to happen again. Now, you would think, at least if it were me, and they'd say, you know, Saul needs a musician, I'd be like, you know, I don't like that gig. That's a tough audience. I don't want to face that anymore. I don't want to go back into that. But David, you know, who knew he'd been delivered from bears and lions and giants, oh my, he's not afraid of King Saul. So he entrusts himself to God's story. God's in control of this. I'm here for a reason. I have a destiny with God. I'm in his hands. He's working this out. Okay, I'll go back in there and play for Saul, even if he's well armed. So, I like this because David, look at what's revealed in this. David, even though he has been personally attacked, is willing to go back in there and face what he's got to face there. You know, so often we get personally attacked. We face something like that and man, we're done. I mean, you know, we bail out quickly from relationships or jobs or churches or whatever if we feel like there's been some personal affront to us. We don't want anything to do with it. We bolt in the opposite direction as fast as we can. But maybe there's a lesson to be learned from David here. Maybe that ability to entrust himself to God and entrust his story to God's hands is a lesson for us to learn that we don't need to ascribe to attackers more power than they really have. You know, they don't have any more power than we allow them to have, even in our own thinking. For David, he knew Saul had no power over him any more than Goliath had over him. God was the one who was in control, and he wasn't going to live like a victim, even so much so that he could walk right back into the same scenario and find himself in the same situation where he's dodging spears and bolting out of there with a guitar case in his hand. He's able to trust that God's in control of those things. He doesn't have to live like a victim or someone who's been victimized. Verse 12, now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. But he had departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and he came in before them. So we see this contrast again between David and Saul. The Lord was not with Saul, and no matter what Saul tries to do, God is with David. No matter how much Saul schemes or hates him or is afraid of him, David's popularity continues to grow. The people around him, there's a groundswell of support. So even giving him more responsibility in the army, you know, the idea was, I don't want him in my presence. I don't need a band anymore. Put him out there in the front lines. Get him out there where it's dangerous because that'll take care of him. But no matter what he tries to do, it says that he goes out and comes in. The idea behind that is that David goes out, to go on patrol or do whatever duties he's doing as a soldier, and he comes back successfully. Each time he goes out and he comes back. He goes out and he comes back. Each time Saul is hoping he's going to get word. He's waiting for the messenger to come and say, well, David's been killed in battle. He was out there in the forefront and they took him out. And each time it's David who comes back saying, well, we did that one for you. What's next? What's the next thing on the agenda? And so no matter what Saul tries to do, he can't undermine what's happening here with David. David's power and popularity is growing right before Saul's eyes. David isn't even trying to do it. Saul is trying to undermine it. And all of the works and all of the failure to do anything on David's part, it means nothing when God is working out his will. God is going to accomplish what God wants to accomplish. And Saul can't stop it. So, David... Again, we see, I can't overemphasize that. Personally attacked, taken down, demoted in some ways. He's kicked out of the palace area. Now he's just a common soldier over other soldiers and all. But he never seems to come across as though he's a victim. We never see David walking around, wringing his hands, lamenting his situation, going, woe is me, poor me, nobody understands me, Saul is mean to me. None of that kind of stuff. David just goes out and does the best that he can do in the circumstances that he's given, and while he's doing that, God is at work supporting him and promoting him and taking him. And the humility of that reveals then that we'll never go wrong taking that road of humility. You know, Saul could have been walking around demanding his rights, saying, this is not fair. You're messing with me, and I'm a hero. I'm a giant killer, and I don't know who you think you are, and I'm friends with your son, and we'll throw your kingdom over, and all these kinds of things. He could have been doing any of those kinds of things, but rather than that, he reveals the humility of his heart. He takes the low road. He submits himself to the authority that's there and entrusts himself to God's hands, and God is at work in all of it. We'll never go wrong taking the low road. So Saul, is constantly at work here trying to undermine David's work. I lost my place. I don't know where I am. Was that obvious or something? Okay, sorry. I just kind of drifted off into my own little coma. All right, verse 17 is where I think I am. Then Saul said to David, here's my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So David said to Saul, who am I? And what is my life from my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? But it happened at that time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, this other guy, as a wife. And I had the pronunciation on that name and I lost it, and I don't want to bog down on it. But so remember when in chapter 17, when Saul had made the promise to the armies of Israel, whoever kills this giant, I'll give him my wife. No, I'll give him my I'll give him my daughter as a wife. Take my wife, please. So he said, I'll give him my daughter as a wife. And so here it's supposed to be making good on his promise. You know, this is what was really actually due to David, because he did kill the giant. Now, you know, you kind of think, well, okay, he's given David this wife, and you know, why is it all of a sudden he's connecting that with the Philistines? How is that going to do it? But the idea is that he's thinking ahead, and we're going to see how this works. He's thinking ahead towards a dowry proposal. You know, the dowry was a sum paid normally to a father's family for the loss of his daughter and all, and so that was something that was a requirement of a father. Father would require a price from the man who would going to be marrying his daughter away. So when David is told of this proposal, you know, I want you to have my daughter, David again responds with humility. David doesn't come back saying, you know, it's about time. You know, I've been waiting around here. You did say I was going to get your daughter in this whole deal, and I haven't seen any chicks. So he, you know, but David responds not with it's about time or it's finally somebody sees what I deserve. He responds with, who am I to receive this? And it's in that humble response, again, that the Lord ends up delivering David from a situation here. Because he's humble in this, because he hesitates, Saul then takes that hesitation. Clearly, he's taking it as an insult. So he turns around, and instead of giving this woman who's already pledged to David, he gives her to another man, probably hoping to incite David to jealousy, anger over this. Well, how dare you? You just offered it to me. Now you're giving it to somebody else just because I hesitated or whatever. But again, we don't see any even mention of David responding to this. There's nothing that says that he said anything. He didn't even seem to shrug. It's just like, okay, it's the king's will. We'll just do whatever the king wants to do. So verse 20, now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. This is his younger daughter. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, I'll give her to him that she may be a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall be my son-in-law today. And Saul commanded his servants, communicate with David secretly. All this sly stuff. And say, look, the king has delight in you and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So Saul's servants spoke those words in the hearing of David. And David said, does it seem to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing I'm poor and a lightly esteemed man? And the servants of Saul told him, saying, in this manner David spoke, according to these words. This is what he said. Then Saul said, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. So, okay, so the younger daughter of Saul loves David, for obvious reasons. He's a rock star. He's a warrior. He's everything. And so Saul, when he finds out about it, says it pleases him. I mean, this is almost like a Disney cartoon. You can see him over there chuckling in the shadows and rubbing his hands together because he's looking at how he's going to use this. He's scheming right away. I can use this to undermine David. I can make this a problem for him. Hey, she'll be a snare to him. And we'll find out more how that goes in his life. That certainly comes to pass. But so obviously he knew his daughter. But there's also something in this because he's scheming in this because he's thinking, okay, I'm going to require something of him. I'm going to require this like a dowry. Now, David could easily have responded to Saul when this comes to him saying, well, all I'm requiring is you to go do this thing against the Philistines. He could have easily said, look, you want a dowry? I got a dowry for you. Here's a giant head right here. You said that anybody who killed him could have the daughter. Now quit messing around with me and give me my wife. But he doesn't, we don't get any record of that. Again, David is humble, recognizing his own position and being cautious as he goes into this situation. So Saul comes up with what is a seemingly an impossible scenario for David to fulfill. How is he going to go do this? And, that's not something that is going to go over easy. And he's assuming that this very task itself is going to be the thing that will kill David and get him out of his hair and take care of it. So verse 26, when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now the days had not expired, therefore, the amount of time that he would have had to do this. Therefore David arose and went, and he and his men, and killed 200 men of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins and gave them in a full count to the king that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. Yikes. Okay, so, David sees this kind of a challenge, the same as a challenge like the challenge that he saw with the Goliath, with the giant. I mean, again, as I said, he could have challenged this whole notion of a dowry. That wasn't right. It wasn't right on Saul's part to do this. But instead, he sees this as a means and a way that he can go out and fulfill the Lord's work and do what it is that he's called to do. I mean, that's part of his job anyway. He's a military guy. This is part of his job. Go out there and do this thing and take out some Philistines in the process. And then still, you get your wife out of this whole thing. So with humility and with faith, he takes his men and they set out and they do this. And this is one of those places where I'm glad the details are missing because I don't even want to know how that all went out or what the count looked like. Okay, verse 28. Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter left him, and Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul became David's enemy continually, or from that day forward. It just, you know, that changed everything. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war, and so it was whenever they went out that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. And so Saul, true to form, instead of seeing that, you know, he recognizes, I mean, that's what's amazing in this. He recognizes that God is with David, and his response is not, oh man, God is with David, I'm fighting against God, I'm messing up here so badly, I repent, God, I'm so sorry. No, not at all. His response is, man, I hate that David guy. I'm going to get him, I'm going to take him out. He's my enemy from this day forward. And so we see that he's sinking down into this miry pit of jealousy and envy and paranoia. And not only that, but he's being set in this. It's not changing for him. He's somehow justifying these kind of actions in his own mind and in his own heart. And so the Philistines go out to war. You know, the war against Philistia escalates again, and so new attacks are underway, and David goes out, and again we're shown that he's a mighty military operator. He's a good tactician. He seems to know how to handle himself in battle. And so he, you know, Saul's thinking was it's going to be by the hands of the Philistines that David is destroyed, and so he keeps putting him in this position where he's there encountering the Philistines, and it's just the absolute opposite. I mean, the plan backfires completely, because it's through his encounters with the Philistines that David's popularity just continues to grow and grow. He keeps going out and winning battles, and everybody loves him more and more and becomes the highly esteemed. So, you know, it's an example, again, of how God will work through all things. No matter what our enemy puts in our paths, no matter what the enemy tries to do to destroy us or use against us, we have the promise of Romans 8:28 that says God will use all things to work together for good. God will work through all of those circumstances to benefit those that love him, who are called according to his purposes. And so that's us. I mean, God, we don't have to be afraid of anything. There's nothing in this life, there's nothing that we face that ultimately is going to destroy us. God's will and works are being worked out, and the moment we believed on him, our destiny was sealed. And nothing's going to change that. Nothing's going to alter that. We belong to him. We're going home to him. And that's a promise that we have that we can count on no matter what happens in this life or in the world around us. So that's a good promise to hold on to. So, Father, we thank you for this story here. Help us, Lord, to read this in such a way that we are participating in it. Help us participate in this story, and let this be who we are. Let this revelation of your word be the very thing that is identifying us as human beings. Help us, Lord, to follow these examples. Make us people after your own heart. Teach us how to be humble in the midst of adverse circumstances, to follow David's example, to take the low road and allow you, Lord, to work on our behalf. Because you did promise in your word that if we will humble ourselves, that you in your own way, in your own time, will exalt us. And we can trust in that. The last thing we want, Lord, is to exalt ourselves. But it means everything to know that you lift us up and hold us close to your heart. So we love you, Lord, and work this in our lives, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. I got something I want us to pray about, but do we have any comments or questions, Brenda?